Hello, friends. This is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Here is the third episode in a series that I'm doing on occult and esoteric Christianity, which is an evolving tradition that offers vitalizing insight into how to move forward. Across these episodes, I'll be talking about various streams and fruits of occult and esoteric Christianity, as well as some of its key figures. Rather than presenting the typically dogmatic, dominating, and totalizing Christianity, which is always in danger of being seized by people, especially conservatives with power, this series will present a different and truer form. Open, wounded, individuated, and powerless. A tradition that relates to other spiritual paths without seeking to control or diminish them. And also, I want to add that it is an occultism, an esotericism, that is not about commanding and controlling the spiritual realm or relating us to materialism in a deeper way. The first in this series, episode 220, featured Reverend Jonah Evans, and the second, 221, featured Reverend Patrick Kennedy, both of the Christian Community, which is a religious renewal movement inspired by Rudolf Steiner and various occult, esoteric-minded theologians. For this episode, I'm moving from looking at esoteric Christianity overall and towards one of its most profound figures, Peter Dunov, who lived from 1830 to 1918. He was also known as Binza Duono. I first heard of Dunov through a quote from Rudolf Steiner. Steiner said to someone interested in anthroposophy, "There is a powerful spiritual movement in Bulgaria headed by a great spiritual initiate." But Peter Dunov's teachings are not like Rudolf Steiner's. They might have the same aims, but Steiner's path, anthroposophy, that which you probably know if you listen to the show, because I mention it all the time, that's a more intellectual path. And it is necessary to have an intellectual path, and the fruits of that path, like biodynamic farming and Waldorf schools and so on and so forth, are really important. But Dunov's path has a different effect on the feeling and thinking, and it inspires a different sort of action in the world. So even though Steiner and Dunov recommended each other's work to their own pupils or audiences, even though it seems they probably never met in person, there's still a very different experience with each of these teachers. Peter Dunov was a Bulgarian spiritual teacher, the creator of a system of spiritual movement called Pan-Eurythmy, which is interesting because Steiner created something called Eurythmy, and a composer. His spiritual teachings, for instance, his expression of the Christian qualities of the pentagram, are seemingly simple sometimes. Even though they're vast, there's a huge body of work, they will sometimes seem simple until you spend a silent moment with them, which is when they reveal their depths, and they just keep getting deeper and deeper as you go. If you're not familiar with Dunov, then there are new lessons there to be found. Like me, you might be one of those people that you're like, you think you've traveled far and wide and found all the sort of mystical, esoteric, spiritual teachings that you're looking for, and then suddenly something opens up for you, and it's not just a small opening, but it is huge. This vista opens up for you. Rather than tell you too much more about him here in this intro, I'm just going to read a passage of his work, which is in an essay, quoted by an essay, written by my guest for this episode, David Lorimer. So I'm going to quote at length here. "The essence of the divine teaching is love, wisdom, and truth. And I know you will ask, what are they? I say to you, eat the kernel. Taste truth, but do not stumble over the shells. Do not ask for proofs. So here is the answer to your question. Love is that without which no life can exist. Wisdom is that without which no movement can exist. Truth is that without which no limit exists. Love is the beginning of life. Truth is the end of life. These are the two limits of the great reality in life. That which moves in between and gives form to things is wisdom. Wisdom cannot act if there is no beginning and no end. Between these, wisdom acts in the space between the beginning and end, which fills all eternity without ever filling it fully. In this space, wisdom moves and reveals what love and truth are, and wisdom says, I that move between the beginning and the end. I say to you, love is the beginning of all creation. Truth is the ultimate limit of creation, its highest goal. And beyond truth there is nothing. It is not possible to go beyond truth. Everything that has been created after moving and moving will finally stop at truth. It might move for millions and billions of years, but when it arrives at truth, there it will stay. You must choose whether you will adhere to the laws of truth and live according to them, or you will turn into dust and ashes. You ask, tell me the truth. Truth cannot be told. It must be lived. Truth is the fruit of the entire life. It includes that in which God reveals himself. It includes all eternity, which is composed of thousands and millions of eternities. For there are eternities which are limited, and there are eternities which are limitless. So remember, if with your love you cannot pass back from the beginning to the end and enter into truth, and if with your truth you cannot pass back from the end to the beginning, you will never comprehend what life is. You must unite the beginning and the end. If you cannot do this, you can do nothing and comprehend nothing. And what can unite the beginning and the end? Only wisdom. That's in David Lorimer's essay, The Principles of Love and Wisdom, in Swedenborg and Bains Adorno, or Peter Dunov. So, a real engagement with Dunov's work can be difficult, in the same way as engaging with other esoteric Christian figures like Steiner or Swedenborg. So I asked David Lorimer onto the show. David is the author and editor of A Prophet for Our Times, The Life and Teachings of Peter Dunov, which was a great intro for me to Peter Dunov's work as far as reading about his work goes. And more recently, a fantastic collection of spiritual essays, A Quest for Wisdom, Inspiring Purpose on the Path of Life, which is what I just read from. He's also the program director of the Scientific and Medical Network, which explores and researches common ground between science, medicine, and spiritual traditions. David has a podcast called Imaginal Inspirations, which features him in conversation with spiritual and scientific luminaries. There's also a great episode where David's daughter interviews him on his own development and how he was deeply influenced by Colin Wilson. I love that episode. Now's the part where I ask you to support the show and give you a thanks if you do support the show. First of all, I want to say that everybody that listens to the show is supporting it in some way. You're engaging with it, and that really means a lot. So thank you for listening and subscribing and talking about the show and taking in what you hear here and turning it into your own conversations. If you'd like to support the show's lifeblood, the way that it can exist in the world as a show, please go to patreon.com/ConorHabib. You can pledge at any amount that fits your situation, either in a one-time annual pledge or in a monthly pledge. So, patreon.com/ConorHabib. Thank you so much. Here's my conversation, mostly about Peter Dunov, with the great David Lorimer. Here we go. Hello, everybody. It's Against Everyone with Conor Habib. Hello, David Lorimer. It's great to be speaking with you.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Conor.
I think we're just going to go right in the deep end to begin with. I'm going to read a passage from Peter Dunov, and we'll take it from there because it's a striking passage, as so many of them are. Resurrection is a process that the Spirit of God performs in our lives. It is a great process, by which God restores that original harmony one day when your ears open and you start to listen a little more and from a bigger distance than now. Now they are very thick. You have not musical skills. You get only the roughest tones. You will notice that some tones that the objects, fountains, trees, leaves, give out, move throughout the entire universe, and you will hear great music that spreads from one end of the world to the other, and then you will understand the internal meaning of life. So I begin there because there's so much in this. There's development, there's a hopefulness, there's a mystery mood in it, and there's a lovingness in this. I think even hearing that, much less the music of the fountains and the stones and so forth, can give us a sense that a different path, a different world is available to us, and in fact may be waiting just for us to know that it's there. So I thought we would start there. It's not a question, but I thought perhaps you would want to just reflect on that with me and move forward.
Yes, thank you. that's quite a passage, as you say. The notion of resurrection is related to that of awakening, to developing the body of light, and to transfiguration. And light is a key metaphor here. And obviously, it's also, as you say, an unfolding process. And it's a process that may take a long time or may take a shorter time. And that depends on the individual. In one of the analogies he used to use was a lot of people in the unfinished state. They are like incomplete paintings. And so if you see someone with rough edges, then it's God is still working on this person to take off the rough edges, to complete the painting. And so it's this, there is a trajectory, if you like, towards this state and this understanding and this sense of harmony. But clearly, it's an evolutionary process, and it can take time. It takes a variable time, and where we are on that path, that's for us to be aware. And the great sages like Dunov are people who have really completed that process. And he explained, for instance, that the White Brotherhood consists of beings who have completed their evolution and who have become totally awake, become the light and love, the image of God that we intrinsically are. But then it's becoming the likeness. It's the process between moving from being the image to the likeness. Where you actually reflect, it's like the polished mirror, if you like. Yes, I think also another thought that comes to mind is the sunrise, because part of the practice in the camps in Bulgaria is to get up before sunrise and witness a sunrise, and the sun rises over the mountains, which is incredibly beautiful. But what he also said, it's very important for the sun to rise inside the human being. And by that he meant, and there's a gesture, which obviously your listeners won't be able to see, but the gesture is moving your hands up from your heart and right over your head and then spreading them out, which is the sun rising and then spreading its light. And so the rising sun is a very important metaphor in the whole teaching of Dunov, and it's one that also comes out in the Panurythmi, which is his sacred dance movements, of which the rising sun is a movement. And so you actually embody that idea, that process, in a series of movements, which really grounds it in a sense. So I think those would be some initial remarks on that passage.
Well, it's I love that you're talking about, you know, first you said, you know, it depends on how quick it happens. It depends on the individual, because on the one hand, we have this individuated path that is ours and that someone can kind of reach. I don't even know if completion is the right word, but they can reach a fullness in it, you know? And then there's also the cultural path and the political path and the economic path, the way that all those things unfold in the world. And, you know, I definitely want to talk about that individual, that togetherness and individualness a bit, but I wanted to just say that, you know, in your writing, you go through this tremendous movement through these different spiritual teachers, pathways, you know, practices, all that. And in some ways, I was just sort of thinking about that as a way of marking the development of consciousness in you as an individual. Instead of, you know, we look at the evolution of consciousness in societies and cultures, and we can look at art and we can look at science and, you know, so on and so forth to notice these things like an Owen Barfield or John Gebser or whatever. But when you look at your own life, you can look at the people who have entered, who have intersected with you and who have had this profound effect. So, you know, you have this Swedenborgian path and then, you know, you come to Peter Dunov and so forth. And I'm just finding myself in Peter Dunov in the past like year or something like that. And I've gone through a lot. I mean, like you, you know, you just sort of go through all these and then you find at each level, something new opens up in you and you keep unfolding and unfolding and unfolding to it. So the reason why I'm talking about this is it's an opening, but also there's a danger to it. And I want to know maybe how you've mediated and worked with that danger, which is the kind of constantly seeking, the constantly bringing new people and new voices in that actually pull you away from that unfolding and development in a way, or can be distracting. It's like going on the path through the fairy tale and every elemental fairy being wants to sell you something, you know, get you in its market, and then you're off the path and then you're stuck there for 100 years, you know, or another lifetime or something. But you've had the ability to move through and yet kind of hold, at least from the outside, it looks like that. Maybe it doesn't feel like that on the inside, from the outside, and hold this kind of tone. And I just wanted to talk about that because we are going to spend a lot of time talking about Peter Dunov, but we'll talk about other people as well. And I don't want people to feel so tempted by a scattering, if that makes sense, as we do that.
No, it does. No, I think the scattering is what our current culture does to us. You know, it disperses, fragments, scatters our attention, you know, which is one of our most precious resources and currencies even. And so, yes, I think the analogy that springs to mind is that use the analogy of going up the mountain, you know, climbing the mountain, which is a very appropriate one to use for Dunov. Because a lot of his work was done in the mountains, then if you're just going around the bottom, wondering which path to go up, you could be there for a long time. And so you actually have to commit yourself and choose a path, and then you go up. And you may meet others further up and other paths, you know, on similar tracks. But I think it's important to, you know, to have some practices which you deepen and which allow you to unfold within a particular, you know, practice or tradition or with a particular teacher. But if you keep starting again and trying something else, then I think this is like it's the activity of the mind. It's a scattered mind. And so I've really committed myself to this path. Not that I'm not interested in many others, and I use, for instance, I use a meditation mantra from the Christian meditation, my friend Lawrence Freeman. I find that very helpful. But I do the Dunhoff exercises every morning. And I pray two of the main prayers every morning. And then I use the formulas as well. And I read these in Bulgarian. And so I read the prayers. And so this morning, it's Monday today. So it's the prayer of the kingdom. And so and then there's also the color for today is green. And there are verses from the Bible, which he organized in the testimony of the colors, color rays of light. There are verses corresponding to green and the principles of abundance, for instance, of giving and receiving. So I think that's those are my thoughts along those lines, and that they were born in a certain place, and we find our way within our own culture, and then a particular path within that culture, and that certainly applied to me.
Yeah, I mean, I found that, you know, for me, you know, it's funny you say we're born in a certain place. I mean, I was brought up with no religion at all, and yet had found myself wanting to deepen that relationship to the spiritual world and most of my life. And, you know, my sort of main headquarters, as anybody listens to my show knows, is Anthroposophy, Rudolf Steiner. But what I realized at some point along the way, because then I went and I studied with some of the people who studied with Daskalos, and now this Peter Dunhoff impulse is coming in, and I'm interested in Valentin Tonberg and whatever, is that that I'm being shown that actually the path is the deepening relationship with Christ and with God, and that the teachers come in to almost to assemble within me the right picture or whatever. But it still does help for me to have that Rudolf Steiner piece, because whenever I get sort of confused about something or whatever, I'm like, I'll go see what he says. He's particularly useful, like Peter Dunhoff, because there's 6,000 lectures or whatever. So you can find almost anything. You're like, okay, here it is. But to check against, but not necessarily to to walk hand in hand exactly, because even though we're all connected in spirit, we're all also alone in the task that's given to us in a way. So I wanted to say that and think about this other thing that Peter Dunhoff said, which is we must no longer think that we alone can improve our lives. I love that. Mm. I love that.
Yes. Mm. Yes. I was actually reading a piece of Eileen Caddy this morning, making exactly that point. And also there's another, I've got a series of books that I have little daily readings of, and there's another Ignatian one as well. He actually was making a similar point that, we're working with the divine, we're working with the invisible forces. So we're not doing it on our own. And it would be arrogant to think that, no, we can do all these things on our own. Oddly enough, one of the books I've just been reviewing is a new book by Harry Salmon. I don't know whether you know that name.
I've actually asked him to be on the show. Is that the Peter Dunhoff and Rudolf Steiner book? Is that the one?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's a very, very interesting book. And the parallels and differences are very interesting, but of course they were both Christ-centered mystics, mm-hmm. and which is what you were saying, and that's really the Western element. But in Peter Dunhoff you also have the Pythagorean Platonic Orphic field coming in, because Bulgaria was Thrace. In the ancient times, and Thrace was where Orpheus is meant to have flourished, and he himself was a musician and composer, and so the music know, links him with Pythagoras and links him with Orpheus as well. And so my note, if you like, is one that embraces that Greek heritage as well as the Judeo-Christian heritage. And this is really what Peter Dunoff was articulating and expressing.
Mm. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm thinking about, you know, this tradition that he's a part of, which is Bogomilism. Saying that,
yeah,
right.
Yes.
You in your book, Quest for Wisdom, you have this one of your essays. I guess it was a talk. You have this Bogomil prayer, which is, "Cleanse me, my God, purify me inwardly and outwardly. Purify body, soul, and spirit so that the seeds of light may grow within me and make me into a flaming torch. I should like to be my own flame so as to transform everything in and around me into light."
It's an amazing prayer, isn't it?
It's incredible, and feels it. There's nothing about it that feels that old, right? It feels utterly contemporary, right, as well. It feels absolutely present. Sometimes you read prayers that are centuries old and there's a feeling to it, you know. I mean, obviously it's translated, but there's a feeling to it that, you know, it feels like that was of that time. But this also really deeply applies to us. And I was thinking of that because, you know, when I was saying we have different teachers at different times in our lives and they come in and sort of show us where we're at on the path and all that sort of stuff, I was thinking about how we become our own teachers again and again through that purification process. Like, I think it is good to pray at night and say, you know, "Not my will, but thine," or, you know, whatever, "Please, I want to do your will, God." But depending on where you're ready for that, the answer might only light up one room in you. It might only give you a piece of that will, but it's through that purifying over time that the light can enter more and more into your being. And then you become your own teacher. I mean, you start sort of looking at who you were and what you did. And I just find that remarkable that that process can happen, and that that prayer is related to, you know, Peter Dunov as well in this new, you know, in his later incarnation or whatever. Mm.
Yes. Well, as you say, it's a very powerful prayer, and it relates back to the passage that you started with, you know, on resurrection and transformation into light, and the movement back to the center as well, which is the symbolism of the second part of the panurhythmi, which is the sunbeams. Mm-hmm. And so you move away from the center, then you move back towards the center. And so there's this movement of breathing in and breathing out, but going away, which is the involution process, and then moving towards, which is the evolutionary process, as you remember that oneness from which you actually sprang. So, yes, I think the sense in which, I mean, for me, I don't regard myself as my own teacher. What I try to deepen is my understanding and embodiment of the five principles of Dunoff: love, wisdom, truth, justice or equity, and virtue or goodness. And these are the five features of the pentagram, which is the third part of the panurhythmi. And in particular, the three central principles of love, wisdom, and truth are even more important than numbers four and five, as it were. And I more deeply understand why he kept on coming back to that. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's the love from the heart, it's the light for the mind, and it's the truth, which is the strength in the will and the capacity to act. And these three faculties or aspects, they have to work together. I mean, for instance, in in the movement Evera, which is the 11th movement of the Panurithmi, and the symbolism there is that you turn towards the center to love, and then towards the periphery or the outside for wisdom, and then you move forward in truth. You step forward in truth, and so it's by combining love and wisdom, the masculine and the feminine, that one is enabled to move forward in truth and put the past behind you at the same time. So yes, that's how these principles are actually embodied in the Panurithmi. And there are many other movements that I could use, but I think the Evera one is probably as good as any.
Well, just to give a little bit of a picture for people listening of this pentagram that you're talking about, you know, the star. So probably people won't be able to visualize this. I'll probably muddy up the waters even more by saying this, but you know, if we start from the top point and come down, come down to the bottom right, that's truth. Yeah. And that's blue. And then if you come up diagonally across up to the left, if you're coming up from your own body, then that's love. And if you come across that horizontal line in the star, that's wisdom. If you come back down to the left is goodness. And then if you go back up from the left up to the top, that's righteousness or justice. But it's always been interesting to me. So there's such a focus in Peter Dunov then, even though he adds those two, as you say, of goodness and justice, we don't have a full pentagram with the ones that he writes about so much. Like, in fact, we have this sort of like, almost like a fish symbol, right? Where it's, if you have truth, love, and wisdom. You have this symbol that's kind of incomplete. And I always thought, as long as I've been...
Well, it's a triangle, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the triangle with an open tail. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it depends which sacred geometry you're using, which form. Mm. And of course, the Star of David is the two interlocking triangles.
That's right.
And the above and the below.
Yeah, that's interesting, right? And so what is that? It's blue, red, and yellow, I think also are the colors that would be included there. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So if that's the case, I want to talk about where goodness and righteousness come in. Because I think, the three that feel very cosmic, right? But the goodness and the righteousness, they feel very earthly in a way. Now, I realize that there are cosmic mysteries behind those as well, but they feel so earthly. It's, a kindness is the other word for goodness, be
kind. Yeah.
And the righteousness that is the final result, the result of a kind of willing, almost a political concern with this last line in the pentagram. How do you think that those emerge from the others? Because again, as with Swedenborg, right, you have love and wisdom and truth and all this, but this seems to be a little more every day in a way that I think can be good for people, but also confusing, because a lot of religious churches and stuff will just kind of focus on the goodness and the justice or the righteousness these days, community potlucks and, soup kitchens and that sort of stuff, which is all good, of course. But I wanted to maybe talk about those.
Yes. Well, I think those are, in some ways, they're the fruits and they're the manifestations. I've never really, thought deeply about the relationship between the three and the two, as it were, but the pentagram itself, as you know, is integral to the whole teaching, and there's a whole symbolism around it. So maybe what you say about the grounding, or the manifestation, is a good way of putting it, because they come out in these qualities, or they're grounded in the social life, in the righteousness and the justice, which is because the whole idea of the brotherhood, sisterhood, or fraternity, or fellowship, is for people to regard themselves as brothers and sisters and behave accordingly. And that's that community, you know, began in Izgrev, in the 1920s, when they created this community and some of the families built their houses there, and then they had a communal room and a lecture hall, and a small, you know, flat that Dunov himself lived in. And so this was an experiment in community and in behaving towards each other in these ways. So I think you if the mind, the heart, and the will are related to these first three principles, those are the three main faculties of the human, and so anything else would have to be, you know, derivative, in a sense, or an expression of those. And I don't know whether he ever wrote about, you know, the origins of the pentagram in the way that we're talking about it now, but it's an ancient symbol, obviously, and it's been used by, you know, by different spiritual traditions and esoteric schools.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, there's the way that it's used in other schools as a kind of protection mechanism, as a protection symbol, but it's not just a protection symbol here, right? It's much more of a developmental symbol.
Path.
Yeah, even to the point where, as you were saying, in panurhythmy, this system of movement or dance or whatever we want to call these gestures, that you walk in it to help sort of develop it within yourself. And I find that interesting as well, that it's not, you know, if you have a magical tradition or something, it's like, well, you just do the symbols and they give you something. But this is, you know, almost we need to make ourselves worthy of these symbols before they even grow in us.
Yes, and I do use it for protection as well, because you can describe a pentagram, you know, above yourself as a form of protection, and I do that at night, and I've read other places where it's used as a form of protection, and it's not something I know a lot about, but still, it's something I have reflected on. And there's a formula. There are formulas that I use when I go to sleep, and then other formulas that I use when I wake up. And I use these every day, you know, without fail. And so they are kind of embedded in the system.
So I'm thinking then about the. Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't say that I don't think that they can protect us or that we shouldn't use them in that way, but it's not sort of the, when I'm talking about magical systems where that sort of being and the meaning that's in them, the kind of richness that's there, is not actually really engaged with. It's more of a tool in some sense. Now, you are using it as a tool for protection, I do as well. And in, you know, the endoskalosis tradition, there's the silver star, which is really just for this purpose. But it's also calling you into a very deep relationship with the form, which I think leads to a different kind of result if you then use it as a tool, if that makes sense. It's like if I know how a tool works, or I'm determined to come into relationship with a tool and I use it, I'm having a very different experience than if I'm just sort of clanging around with the hammer, you know, if you know what I mean.
Yes. I mean, that's a level of engagement, isn't it? I think I don't dance the pentagram very often, because it's, unless I'm in the mountains, you know, with the group, then, you know, you have to have 10 people in order to do it. And then the people who do it, they have to know it quite well. Otherwise, it's just a mess. You know, it's and so it's a bit like, you know, more complicated Highland reels. You know, if people don't know how to do them, then they, you know, they don't work. So it's not, as I say, I mean, I do. Yesterday morning, I was teaching a friend, you know, the first 10 movements. She never came across this before, and also the exercises, you know, the first day of spring. And so I would do the first set of movements and the first part, you know, much more often than I would do the others. You know, simply because of the, you know, I'm doing it by yourself as well. You really need other people to do it with. And which is the point of the, you know, experience in the mountains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that group action then, you know, it reminds me of something else he said, which is we refer to the law of love as a link between souls. The law of love demands mutual aid between human beings. First of all, I want to say I really like that he uses the term mutual aid, which is now becoming really deeply popularized in sort of regular, even leftist political lexicon with, you know, anarchist traditions and, you know, all that, finding a resurgence during the pandemic and people helping each other and their neighbors and all that sort of stuff. But I also like that, you know, what you're talking about is, well, we have our development, but we can't think that we can improve our lives on our own. So we also need the spiritual world, but also when we engage with others, we can see that forms are available to us that just aren't available out there, you know, to just one person at a time, that we need to gather, and that mutual aid happens, you know, when there's love there. So I love that you're talking about this form. I mean, I can also imagine a bunch of us just bumping into each other, trying to form this pentagram because we don't really know how to do the panurhythmy, and eventually getting there over time, you know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned mutual aid, because I've become very interested in this. I mean, I have the original Kropotkin book from 1900-something. But recently there's a book which I reviewed called Mutual Aid, The Other Law of the Jungle, by Pablo Servigne and Gautier Chappelle. And I got Gautier to do a piece for a new book that I'm editing with Irvin Laszlo, called The Great Upshift. And I've you know, spoken to other people who've been using the principle, and I think it's one that has some potential mileage in it, because it's quite easy for people to understand the principle. And if you call it the other law of the jungle, you know, everyone for themselves is the first law of the jungle, the survival of the fittest. But in fact, when it comes to societies, then the societies that support and sustain and help each other are the most successful, and therefore mutual aid is in fact a survival imperative within a social context. And the other thing I like about it is that it is horizontal, and so it's not somebody with a lot of money giving philanthropic help to a project, usually in pursuit of their own aims, and which may or may not be, you know, commercially aligned, and often are. But it's something where people are supporting and helping each other, and it's something that can be applied, you know, very much locally in your community. And in fact, in the area that I live in, there is a sort of mutual aid cell, it's called, you know, which people locally are part of, and they offer help and advice to each other, help, advice, and support. And the other important point here is it's decentralized. And so it's self-organizing and decentralized, which and these are the principles which I think we need to be moving forward with, because what we hear about, you know, from the World Economic Forum, the UN, governments, and so on, it's all top-down. No centralized command and control, And that doesn't correspond to the way nature works. Nature doesn't work by command and control. Nature works by complexity, self-organization, diversity, mutuality, symbiosis, synergy, cooperation. I mean, there's competition as well, obviously, but often the competition involves cooperation at another scale, if you like, or the result of the competition, like in the prey-predator balance, is the ecosystem balance, which means that things can continue harmoniously in their unfoldment.
Yeah, the way that my main mentor in life is Lynn Margulies, and she would always say, you know, you could look at a basketball game and you can see people competing, but if you stand back, you see that they all had to agree to come here, you know. And if you just keep stepping back, you know, she would say that Gaia's symbiosis seen from space, that you that the largest unit really is a cooperative unit, and things are sort of pushing and pulling inside that unit. You know, it can look like real competition. I think that that's, you know, when you talk about the top down stuff, you can really only with that sort of top down direction where there's an appeal to the state or to corporations to solve our problems. It's not like they're not capable of doing anything, right? But so often they're just sort of resisting. But even when they do good things, they're just kind of resisting the bad stuff that they created, or they're solving problems that they've created. Whereas the mutual aid stuff is much more about, you know, creating good amongst each other. It's not just about resisting evil or overcoming evil, because you have to meet each other. You have to take an interest in each other in a way. You have to come together in a way that it doesn't necessarily always involve warmth, but it's more likely to involve a sense of warmth and a sense of meeting and encounter. One of the people that I've had on the show a bunch of times is Dean Spade, who wrote a book called Mutual Aid. And he's a trans rights lawyer. Well, he wouldn't like the word rights, a trans liberationist lawyer, but also now does all this anarchist work around mutual aid. And, you know, his whole thing is like, no one from the top is going to come to save us. In fact, we just have to meet each other. We just have to be there for each other. And so I love that you took it all there. I mean, I think when you're talking about the aspects, the scientific aspects of it, it's something that comes up for me when I read your writing and where you go, is that, so there's this whole scientific enterprise in your life and this whole interest in consciousness and where it fits in. And then there's this Peter Dunov, aspect, which is very strong. Obviously, you have these other spiritual associations and teachers as well, but there's this sort of center here. And I wonder how that flows into the consciousness stuff, the science stuff, how those two sort of move in and out of each other. Because I was led to Rudolf Steiner by Lynn Margulies, by science. Okay. This is kind of inadvertently, right. You know. So I had started with science, and then I ended up in, you know, my weird, you know, mystical, magical mystery tour, which is still ongoing. But you have this science work at the center of your life and your work, and also this spiritual teacher who definitely talks about health and science and all that. But if someone were to try to find the connection, you know, just on the surface, it might be a little hard.
Well, not necessarily, but I understand what you mean, because they're different focuses. And I'm interested that Lynn Margulies was associated with Steiner, because I wasn't aware of any connection between.
I'll tell you the connection. You and her. Yeah.
No, but I did meet Lynn, at a meeting that we were both at in Italy. Which was very, very interesting. Very, very interesting. And I'm a great admirer of her work. So obviously the mystical state or mystical states are, you know, states of consciousness. And we have, for long, in fact, I've been organizing this myself for, you know, decades, the Mystics and Scientists Conference. And the first one of these took place in 1978. And the first one I attended, because I was teaching at Winchester College at the time, was 1981. And then I began starting to organize in the sort of late 80s, mid to late 80s. And we're now on number 45. And the point about the Mystics and Scientists Conference is related to different complementary approaches to reality, if you like. And that the scientific and medical network was always trying to balance intuitive insights with rational analysis. And if I translate that into Ian McGilchrist's speak, it becomes the right and left hemispheres as different modes of attention. And so the intuitive, the imaginative is a very important way of knowing. And then the rational is another way of knowing or of analyzing. And the scientific, the experimental, is its own path. And so the part of the relationship between the two is the relationship between experience and experiment. And these derive from the same root. And the experimental is obviously characteristic of the science, although you can do experiments in spirituality as well. And the experience is characteristic of the mystical spiritual path. So that the impulse of the Mystics and Scientists Conference is really the quest for unity and understanding at these different levels, and particularly the quest for unity or unification or union even. And so that's what I think the two paths have in common. And so each year we select a theme, you know, which can be addressed both from the scientific and the mystical angles. And what I've observed in the last period, you know, since I've been organizing these conferences, is that the distinction between mystics and scientists is becoming less and less sharp. Mm-hmm. Because quite a few of the scientists who speak at our conferences are themselves mystics as well. And so it's not on the way these conferences started is you had the scientists in one camp, as it were, and then the mystics were over in another camp. And they listened and exchanged, but they weren't in the same person. Mm-hmm. And someone like Fritjof Capra, though, you could say, and he was one of the speakers at the first conference and also the 40th anniversary. I don't know if he'll still be around for the 50th anniversary. He might be. It's another 5 years. he's a mystical scientist. You know, he's a scientist who had mystical experiences, and his book, original book, The Tao of Physics, you know, is precisely an exploration of the interface. So I think the common ground is in terms of ways of knowing, but the mystical way of knowing is the knowing by identity, by gnosis, by knowing immediately, and whereas the scientific form of knowing is more indirect, and it isn't indirect if you're Goethe, but normally it is indirect because you are you're sort of removing yourself as an observer or an experimenter. And although what's happening now, of course, is that people are realizing, like Max Planck, that you can't get behind consciousness, that consciousness is inevitably has to be involved in scientific endeavor as well as in the mystical search.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I I love that overview of it. I think, how do I start with this? So, I mean, part of the issue with some of this field, though, is for me, as someone who was pretty deep in the sort of sciencey version of that for a while. So Lynn told me to go to this 3-month program at the Nature Institute with Craig Holdridge, and that's where I met.
Okay.
You know, so that's
I met Craig recently, actually.
Okay, yeah, great. So I studied Cartesian science for every day for 3 months. And that really blew my brain out of. Yeah, I mean, it was pretty potent. But I think that some of that world, and I know a lot of people in it, it has this tendency, I think, even on the mystical side, to do this thing where the mystical and Tao of physics, even if Fridjof didn't mean it this way, it, I think, got taken up this way, where the scientific discoveries validate the mystical understanding, if you see what I mean, where it's like, oh, wow, it's actually true, you know, where the burden of ignorance is always placed on the sort of mystical side of things. But then the other thing happens where you find people who are in that kind of mystical world seeking a kind of validation from science as well. Now, I understand as a political function that sometimes that's actually necessary when you're trying to, I don't know, get acupuncture covered by health insurance, for example. Like, these things kind of have to happen, especially in medicine. But I do think that sometimes that interplay can drive us deeper into a problem of materialism, where what, in my perspective, in my experience and encounter with the spiritual world, is that we're also being asked to dissolve materialism as a perspective entirely. And this becomes, it's not that we dissolve matter, or that, you know, matter has an importance in our existence, obviously, but the way that we apprehend and understand it, it's so dense, literally and figuratively, that unless we start sort of dissolving that entirely, we become victims of, or drive ourselves deeper into the problem. This has all kinds of insidious ways of finding its way into our spiritual lives. So, for instance, one that I've brought up a few times on the show is, you know, people are clairvoyant. They'll think that that's a spiritual faculty. However, if someone says to me, and I'm clairvoyant, where did I lose my necklace or whatever? And I'm like, you know, close my eyes and I see someone putting it behind the dropping it behind the refrigerator the other day or whatever, I'm like, it's behind the refrigerator. If I'm still perceiving images of the physical world that are given to me by the senses based on physical properties, then I'm reinforcing the physical images, and I'm reinforcing the attachment to the physical world by saying I have a spiritual property, or spiritual capacity. And I think it sneaks in all these ways that I worry about in these conjunctions of science and spirit. There can be a danger there as well. And I'm sure this has come up. I mean, you've done this so many times now that I'm sure that these kinds of concerns come up and you see them, and that they must be mediated, you know, poorly by some people and really well by others. And, you know, the discussion is open, the conversation. So actually, I'm just actually now interested in the times that people have been mediating that tension.
Yes, well, I would regard what the clairvoyant faculty, I would say, well, it's really a psychic faculty rather than a spiritual faculty. Mm-hmm. So I put psychic between the material and the spiritual, if you like. Although advanced sages, you know, will always be clairvoyant. Mm-hmm. You know, they will always. It's the siddhis, if you like. It's that they will have these capacities, you know, reading minds, and sometimes, you know, disappearing or appearing in another place. And you know, those are siddhis which you shouldn't pursue, but they can happen simply as a result of, you know, evolution of consciousness. And so I don't think that either mysticism or science should look to the other for validation. And I see it as a matter of levels or a matter of complementarity, the matter of using different eyes. And so if I can use the Bonaventure scheme, he talks about the eye of contemplation or the eye of the heart. which is the eye of oneness, the Gnostic eye, the eye of gnosis, and then the eye of reason, which is the logical eye and systematic eye, and then the eye of sense, which is, you know, self-explanatory. And so with science and theology and the church, they tended to operate only on the eye of reason and the eye of sense. And the eye of contemplation is the mystical eye, and mystics more often than not, certainly so far as theologians are concerned, unless you're a mystical theologian, they're the heretics. They're the prophets. They're the people who embody and are in touch with and express the spirit. So in that sense, Dunov was very much a prophet in relation to the priests of the Orthodox Church. The prophet is the live wire, if you like, whereas the priest has a conservative function, and often, you know, conserving the institution and making sure that the institution has a role to play, whereas the Gnostics they don't like authority. The mystics, they don't need authority. They don't need someone else to tell them what to do, because they're doing it. And I think the scientists, I mean, just coming back to the scientists and transformation, it's become very obvious to me that what changes people are personal experiences, that yet another experiment or another parapsychological paper, it doesn't really have very much effect, especially on the more hard-boiled or hard-nosed materialistic people who won't even look at it. They know in advance that there's nothing in it, so why would one waste one's time? And it reminds me of a interview with Rupert Sheldrake and Peter Atkins from Oxford, and they were meant to be talking about telepathy, and Rupert had sent Peter a couple of papers to look at, papers that he'd written, peer reviewed, in advance of the discussion. He didn't bother to read them. He said, "I don't need to read them because I know there's no such thing as telepathy." Mm-hmm. And that takes the conversation in a slightly different direction. But it is the issue that we're dealing with in the Galileo Commission really all the time, is this kind of resistance to looking at evidence that it contradicts really the materialistic understanding of life, science, and consciousness.
Yeah, well, I know that you've spoken with Evan Alexander on your podcast, and I wrote a long time ago, I think he's great, but I wrote an essay that was a little critical of his book a long time ago, because I thought...
Which book? Because he's written three.
Proof of Heaven, sorry, yeah.
You
know, I think the essay was called Heaven is Proof or something like that, where, you know, the problem is the method and the results itself. It's no longer, it's not necessarily that the method can really give us what we're looking for, and that the seeking of proof in this certain way. I mean, you mentioned Max Planck before, you know, at the Max Planck Institute, the sort of main figure there now is Lorraine Dasein, who co-wrote this book called Objectivity, which is just about changing forms of, you know, objectivity in history and how that the concept of objectivity has changed over time. So if, you know, the concept has changed over time, then certainly the methods for, you know, exploring and understanding what that might be has changed. And the method, you know, when I learned Gertian science, that method is just very different, and it produces different results, and they're consistent, you know, much less if you're doing spiritual scientific research, which is a completely different method altogether and has different results. And so I think maybe that's part of the thing, and why I brought up Evan Alexander was this, you know, there was I understand again why he did it, and I'm very sympathetic to it, but there was this proofiness of it, like, I'm going to prove this to you, that actually it's just never going to, that's never going to work in the same way.
No, I agree with you, but that title was his publisher's title.
Yeah, I forgive him.
For that. You know, it wasn't his title. And you know what, you know, no self-respecting scientist would agree with a title like that. But it sold a lot of books. I think that's unfortunate, because you're right. I mean, there's experimental proof is very well defined. And in fact, you can only, with the inductive method, you can only go so far. And a proof, strictly speaking, is really sort of mathematical proof, you know, which is self-consistent. And you can't get a proof in science as anything empirical in the same sense as you can get a logical or mathematical proof. So it's a witness, if you like. You said a witness of heaven in inverted commas, but even that all needs to be put in inverted commas as well, because the idea that the average evangelical American would have of heaven, would not be quite the same. So I agree. I think the impact of it was that this was a neuroscientist having the experience, and it completely changed his understanding of consciousness. That's really the important point about the book, and obviously the work he's been doing ever since.
Well, okay, God, there's so much that I don't want to let too much of it go, but I'm thinking about this. What you said is, well, experiences will change people, but the difficulty with that, and I'm not exactly sure we can do it in relation to science, is the ways that people prescribe these extraordinary changing experiences, again, tend to end up driving people deeper into materialism. So, for example, something that's so popular right now, popularized by, you know, people I like, but I don't agree with them, but I like them, Graham Hancock, Michael Pollan, whatever, is like, let's do hallucinogenic drugs to have a spiritual experience. It'll give you, you know, a kind of spiritual antibody to fight off materialism or whatever. But that itself ends up funneling people deeper into materialism very often, because it ends up being, one, a substance that they've done to achieve a spiritual experience through the damaging of their organs. So they're going through a pathway that produces a quite narrow result, actually. And you only encounter this little sliver of the spiritual world with these beings that who knows if they're, you know, worth contacting anymore now that their dimension is like a tourist trap. But also, you know, it doesn't require the work that leads through these stages of development, which are different for everybody, which relate to our karma, which relate to who we are as individuals, which relate to an unfolding process. So, you know, I worry about also the prescription of, I agree with you that it has to be through these transformative experiences, but then I also worry about the ways that those will then be prescribed to funnel us back in to a kind of material.
Yeah, I mean, it depends what sort of experience we're talking about. And obviously, a psychedelic experience is one kind of experience, but then people can have spontaneous awakenings. In the book that Marjorie Woolacott and I edited last year, Spiritual Awakenings, and some of the people write about psychedelic experiences, but most of them, it's not a psychedelic experience. It's an altered state of consciousness, or it's a gradual realization through an ongoing process, and that changed their view. And the reason that we put the book together was, you know, to get firsthand from academics and scientists how they had been transformed from, you know, a purely materialistic outlook to one that included the material but transcended it at the same time, or was to be seen within a wider framework. So it's that, and I think the, so far as psychedelic experience is concerned, it also depends on the context of that. And so I the person who's actually staying in my village at the moment is called Frederique Apfel-Maglin, and she's written on South American shamanism. She has a center in Peru, and she's an emerita professor at Smith College, near Boston. And so she's done a lot of field work, but also in the history of ideas and the way that this animistic worldview, was cancelled, as it were, by mechanistic materialism and the churches, in the 16th and 17th century. And what one of her main points is that we now need to recover this at a different turn of the spiral, the feminine, the intuitive, and the worlds that are opened up by these experiences. So I think it also depends on whether the intent with which you take a substance is spiritual or recreational. And it can be part for her, for instance, when she arrived in 1994 in Peru, she met some of the local shamans. They said, well, you have to do some ayahuasca, otherwise you won't know what's going on here. And the same happened to John Perkins, who I interviewed quite recently. And so it's not necessarily something to recommend, and it's quite a divisive topic. I mean, one of my colleagues is very against any use of hallucinogenics, and I understand that position as well, because they say you really got to go the meditation route, the spiritual practice route, and you'll get to the same place, but you'll get there in a different way. So it's quite a complex area, and of course it involves psychedelic psychotherapy, which Michael Shapiro was talking about in an interview or talk that he gave us last week. And that's now becoming more and more mainstream. And what I find really interesting about that approach is that it's clear that the mystical experience component is the therapeutic agent in these cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a potent point to say, I mean, with any medicine, with any treatment, who we are will reveal the efficacy of the medicine when it's given to us. And that's true if we take aspirin or if we take ayahuasca. I think with something like ayahuasca, if you live in or grow up with certain images, colors, beings around you, if your world is populated by a certain elemental presence, you're much more likely to engage with the beings that you see and encounter them through ayahuasca differently. I think it's hard for me to go down the path of, well, if we just have a shaman guiding us, we could, but I don't even really necessarily want to get into that too deeply with you. Just to say, I think sometimes the whole point was to say, I think sometimes the solutions or the pathways we take to confront materialism can sometimes make us go deeper into it. And I think that that's one of the dangers or tensions, especially when we're talking about looking at science and looking at science. Science brings its own beings with it as well. When you go see the allopathic doctor, which of course probably most of us have done at some point in our lives, and it can help, but it does bring then a set of beings with it as well. And most of us are not equipped. There's a kind of equipment or equipping on our own end that needs to go into the room of talking to even the willing scientist, I think. And again, I say this as someone who was deeply educated and mentored by really incredible scientists. So it's not a diss on that. But okay. One of the things that Peter Dunov said that is also making me think of this is, truth and proof aren't the same thing, right? Because he said, truth cannot be told, it must be lived. I love this. Why you point this out again in your short essay about Peter Dunov in your book is, truth is the end of life is something that he said. And then elsewhere he says, why should we die to be to be rid of the present world without love. So truth is something that connects us to the death process, to the dissolution of materiality in our lives, to the losing of all conditions of matter. Truth has this whole arc that can't be known until life, until material life, until incarnation dissolves. It's something I really like about Goethean scientists. What you see them do a lot of times is they'll take the plant and they'll take every leaf form across its entire life cycle.
I've seen
and
those.
Line it up. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's not, truth can't be fixed in time. Proof can. Proof can be fixed in time at a moment, but truth has to be seen over time, almost till the end of time. That's the Christ. At the end of time, you'll know the truth. You'll know why I'm here. So the end of history, the end of humanity, then we'll know. So yeah, I was just thinking about that as you were talking then, about the differences between truth and proof and truth's relationship to death.
Well, that's, yes, I mean, for me, the most important thing is this association of truth with freedom and liberation. And that the truth will make you free is a famous quotation from Jesus. And that equation was really made by Dunhoff as well. And it's made, the idea of liberation generally in other spiritual traditions is one of knowing the truth, of knowing that you are that same one consciousness or mind or divinity that everything in fact is, which is the sort of textbook definition of gnosis. And that is really dying to the smaller self, if you like, rather than death as such. And it's what I find really interesting is that it's reciprocal. And some of the new thought thinkers like Thomas Troward, they realized that the ultimate realization is reciprocal in the way that Eckhart says, when the eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees in me, or with which God sees me. And that is a statement of circularity and reciprocity. This is the finest cognitive realization that we can have, because it recontextualizes, it moves the self into the self with a small s into the self with a large s, if you like, and just a change of view and vantage point. And this I call this part of the cosmic game, and because I think the cosmic game in a Gnostic sense is one of descent and ascent, sleeping and waking up, forgetting and remembering. And Plotinus said, forgetting, remembering is for those who have forgotten, which in fact is almost everybody. But that seems to me built into the cosmic process. And that's why I call it a game, because, each time, each incarnation or each person, is playing that same game, and that they need to remember who they are. We need to remember who we are. And it might happen at any time, but it might not happen at all. And then, of course, if you realize that oneness, then it's an experience of light, but it's also an experience of love, because the reciprocity then gives you the realization that we are one another. And that's how we should ethically behave to each other.
Yeah, I think of that as the, the spiritual lesson, which is almost, I think, repugnant to people now, which is that, anything bad that happens to you in your life is because of you, but anything good that happens in your life is by the grace of the gods or God, which sounds so awful to people now, because we want to take credit and we also don't want to be blamed for what we do. But
there's a really loving way to look into that, which I'm actually not going to go into right now. So people that frustrated who are listening, just mull over it for a bit and you can, you know, yell at me in email or something like that later. Mm-hmm. But the reason why is I'm thinking of something that's in, you know, this book. You know, Peter Dunov brings up in relation to the color red, the spirit of love, this passage from 2 Corinthians, which is, who comforts us in all our tribulation, that we may be able to comfort those who are in any trouble by the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. And we can think about that eye looking upon us and us looking back, you know? And I think also we can think about if we've ever had a friend who was crying in front of us and we reach to touch them and put our hand on their shoulder and bring some peace to them. That is also when we're in tribulation and we find somewhere in ourselves that source of comfort. That's the same comfort. And that's the same being coming through us to comfort the other that comes to us inwardly in our comfort. And then we know that God is present with us, so that it's not necessarily the connection that you were talking about, which I also think is a really profound one. And when we can sense it, it's really lovely and loving. But to bring it to the level of just when's the last time you helped someone who was in need, who came to you and you embraced them or you helped them. And that same flow, that same current is God working through you when you come to yourself to find that place of calm when you're anxious, even if it's just for a moment.
Mm.
And then you fall back into the anxiety. Still, you know that that's there. And you know that it's there because you can comfort others. So you can see this whole kind of cycle. And then when someone comes to comfort you, it's the same comforter. You know, it's
yes, same. I love that. I love that. The Holy Spirit, the comforter. Mm-hmm. And that whole, it's not something that one talks about very much. You know, people don't talk about using the word. Comfort is more, you know, related right. to social than comforting people. Mm-hmm. But it's part of our humanity. It's part of our heart. You know, to reach out to people. And what reaches out within us, as you say, is something, is a universal quality, and which has always been characteristic of the divine. You're right.
That is it. I mean, I think if you know, there's so much being done, you know, in the world of intellectualizing spirit, and I think that's very important work. It certainly is important work when we start allowing our spiritual understandings to infuse the economic realm and the political or rights realm. But that warmth, you know, that's something in Peter Dunov's work, which is so important, you know, to me. When I think of Rudolf Steiner, he is very warm and sometimes even quite funny, but the fruits and the presence in the world is highly intellectualized. I mean, because he's working with the intellect, and purposefully he almost is asking us to use it to find a line of flight so we can overcome it in a way. Mm. And, you know, when I think of Daskalos, he's also very warm, but he's a healer. He's healing people. Swedenborger is, again, more this sort of intellectual, religious, yeah. but intellectual soul. But Peter Dunov is the parable soul. I mean, he's the being that, he arrives, he tells us the story. The story has many layers. The utterance has many layers, and they're transparent. They're all transparent to each other. You can find new meaning and new meaning and new meaning because he says it all at once on every level. Mm. And that's very Christian. You know, that's very deeply Christ-like. And so, or maybe literally Christian, depending on where what you want to believe about his incarnation. But that always brings a warmth, you know, that kind of storytelling always brings warmth. And that's so important. And I think, unfortunately, can be lost in even the ways that we approach esoteric and occult Christianity, not just the religious kind or the megachurch kind or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, the love brings warmth to the heart. He says, you know, wisdom brings light to the mind. Love brings warmth to the heart, and truth brings strength to the will. So this idea of strength and the strengthening of the will is also important. But in Harry points this out in his book on Dünhoff and Steiner, that Dünhoff comes more from the love angle and Steiner more from the light angle, if you like, even if they're complementary and both include the other. Because it with love and light, or love and wisdom, they're as experienced, they're experienced as one. So you could take any experience of the mystics or the near-death experiences, and that the light is always loving, or the love is always, you know, embodied in light. And so these aren't two, they're you can refract them into separate qualities, but they are inherently divine qualities. And he said, you know, he said the love of God brings fullness and abundance of life. And that's the grace. Izobilnia I pelen život. And so this fullness, then the importance, the centrality of love. Love brings life, he said. You've got the love, life, light, and liberty, if you like, four L's.
So I suppose the last thing I want to ask you here is, you know, in this scientific and social scientific work that you're doing, I wonder if you, what you do about having this position of being deeply related to Christianity, because we're not just talking about, you know, sometimes people are like, oh, well, the Dalai Lama, he's into science or, you know, whatever. Like, they'll accept it from other religions, but, you know, I mean, rightfully so, there's a deep suspicion of, you know, how Christianity has handled science. I mean, it's like, I mean, if I look at that spiritually and what people are doing, I think, well, Christians did a lot to banish and hide the elemental kingdom, the kingdom of the spirits that constitute the world, to glorify and exalt a certain picture of God. And there was some even maybe appropriateness in that, not in its violent, you know, extremes, but perhaps some kind of a purity sort of thing that was happening that might have been necessary a long time ago. And then science, you know, was like, well, no, we're going to reveal these beings to you again by controlling them and making them sort of jump through hoops for us in a certain way. So like both of them wanted to sort of dominate these elemental kingdoms for different reasons. But I would say that, you know, that wound is really still there for people with a scientific worldview, not about necessarily other spiritual traditions as much as Christianity. Christianity had so much power, you know, institutionalized Christianity has so much power. What do you, does that come to you at all? Particularly the esoteric Christian piece. I mean, I know from reading your work, my understanding is that, you know, obviously you're not trying to, you don't have some furtive motive about like destroying science or something like that. But people might think, well, but there's that Christian part. It's not just a spiritual, you know. And I wonder if you've had.
Well, yes. I mean, I think there are different interfaces here, and so the restrictive interface for me would be the interface of science/theology, and that's the formal propositional, authoritative, or related to authority. Then you've got the science esoteric, which Eddie Villamoria, for instance, has written about, and that the esoteric view doesn't see science at all as incompatible with esotericism. It just says that the scientific view needs to be widened and deepened to include and what they call esoteric science. And then you've got the scientific and the mystical. And I think the network operates on the scientific, mystical, scientific, spiritual, which is the fourth one, and the scientific, mystical, not the scientific, theological. And the esoteric and the spiritual and the mystical, they all relate to experience rather than reason as such. And so they all bring in this, what I said earlier, it was about the eye of contemplation. And so I see there's a complementarity here. And I think for the people who are Christians, but who are also scientists, I mean, there's a Christians in Science group, there's the Science and Religion Forum, and there's the Faraday Institute. These are all organizations that major on this scientific, theological basis, and that's where I see these issues coming up, because obviously science arose, and some people put this very positively, you know, within the Christian culture, mm-hmm. but it arose in a certain way that you know, as you say, there are still residual tensions, especially when the two approaches are meant to be comprehensive, because in fact religion can't be comprehensive, and nor can science. And if either of them, you know, claim the whole epistemological and ontological territory, if you like, then they've overreached themselves. And so my answer to your question is, it very much depends on which interface you're operating on. And I'm quite happy operating on the esoteric, mystical, spiritual interface with science, and I don't see that there's a problem with authority, in that respect.
Good. All right. Yeah. Well, listen, Dave Lorimer, I mean, honestly, I could just go on and on with you. There's so much to talk about, and there's so much science stuff and Peter Dunov stuff and John Moriarty, who didn't even get to him. I live in Ireland. I wanted to talk with you about him, but you know, we'll speak again. Thank you so much for all your work and for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Connor. Very good to be with you.
Thank you. And thanks everybody for listening. Bye now.